So as I said, it's so lovely to be here. I'm really looking forward to just sharing and talking about some of these ideas. And it was so nice to reconnect with these original writings of Dr. Holmes. It's been a while since I actually took it off my shelf and dusted it off and read it. And actually, I downloaded it on my Kindle, you know, which is lovely to be able to do that. And that it's been almost 100 years that he wrote these words and that they still are so relevant today. And I think what I was struck as I was reading the excerpts that Connie had sent me, that you were reading, is really the energetic vibration of it. You don't, it doesn't really matter what the words are. It's just an aligning with a divine truth in a way that is so powerful that raises our vibration and our awareness. And just sitting in those words is a spiritual practice all its own. So I loved doing that. And it also strikes me, as Connie mentioned, we started a long, long time ago in this study. It's been almost 30 years that I started really formally studying religious science. And back then, I was amazed at how relevant Ernest Holmes was. And then 30 years later, he's almost more relevant because of all the science that has coming forward, the neuroplasticity and epigenetics and positive psychology, and they're really studying these techniques and ideas that we've just been doing because it was a spiritual practice and it felt good to us and we got results and it was a spiritual truth for us. And now they're confirming the science, even though we knew it was a science all along, but the affirmation of these amazing sciences that say, it's not just the spiritual practice that makes me feel good. There are real, real benefits in my brain, in my body, in my emotions, not to mention the attracting and the creating and the drawing to us because of these practices. So it's just a win-win situation, really, as the science comes forward and brings us more awareness. So I love what G.K. Chesterton said about happiness. He said, happiness cannot be traveled to, owned, earned, worn, or consumed. Happiness is the spiritual experience of living every minute with love, grace, and gratitude. And that's what we do, isn't it, in Science of Mind and in your study group. And that is our quest, our intention, I think, to live in love, grace, and gratitude. That is really the intention of all these practices and the study, the deepening that we go into. And so as we talk about these passages and expand on these ideas, I think that that's really the nugget, is that it's the practice. It's really the practice. It's not just the ideas or the thoughts that are, it's this setting into motion our practice of these principles that really align us with our happiness and our divine. So the passages that I selected just a couple of paragraphs that I really wanted to expand upon, and I was really happy to get these because it was really what I've been thinking about anyway, of course. So the two excerpts are on the control of thought, which in itself, again, is really part of that practice. What does that really mean? And the quote, the part that I'm drawing out from, is this. I'll just read it to you. The reason we can make our requests known with thanksgiving is because we know from the beginning that we are to receive, and therefore we cannot help being thankful. This grateful attitude to the spirit puts us in very close touch with power and adds much to the reality of the thing that we are dealing with. Without it, we can do but little. So let us cultivate all the gratitude that we can. In gratitude, we will send our thoughts out into the world, and as it comes back to us, we'll become laden with the fruits of the spirit. That attitude, cultivating gratitude, is again one of those spiritual practices that I want to expand on. I really want to talk a little bit more because there have been some really wonderful studies and research through positive psychology mostly on the benefits of gratitude. And in fact, the book that I read talked about is called Thanks by Amon. His first name is Richard or Robert. But tagline to it is something about the new science of gratitude, the study of the new science of gratitude. That's just some amazing things that they have come together. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Thanksgiving and gratitude, and then the combining with the other excerpt that we read about creating atmosphere. And I listened to Connie's talk a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and it's a similar thing about the aura, creating the aura. So it's like the creating the atmosphere for experiencing our good. And so there's a couple of little tidbits out of that I'm going to expand upon. And Ernest Holmes says that a person can create such a strong mental atmosphere of success that its power of attraction will be irresistible. But first we must clear our thoughts of unbelief. And without mental clearness on the part of the thinker, there can be no real creative work done. And I think I would expand that, not only mental clarity, but I think more than ever, emotional clarity. That Ernest Holmes didn't talk as much about emotional clarity, but it's in there. And we know, since we're open at the top, what he was talking about that time was really about taking control of your life through your thoughts. But we know so much more about how to bring emotional clarity into our lives through our own practice of the science of mind. So I'm going to talk about the emotional clarity and some of those ideas. I've been taking this online class by Rick Hansen. He wrote the Buddha Brain, I think he wrote, and the class is called The Enlightened Brain. And he combines neuroscience with Buddhism and psychology. So it's kind of all up my alley. This is really some powerful stuff. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of his ideas and how that plays into this. So Ernest Holmes said, again, in one of these quotes, "In the mind of God, there is the correct mold, the true knowing. But in the mind of man, there is not always this true knowing." It's there. And the practice, again, is often bringing ourselves back to that truth. Bringing ourselves back to that truth, going off and then bringing ourselves back to that truth. And Rick Hansen shares that because of our survival mechanism, because of our genetics, the negative experiences that we've had stick with us more than the positive. He said the negative are like Velcro and the positive experiences are like Teflon. And the reason, of course, is that when we were out in the wilds, it was the negative experience that stuck with us that saved our lives. The playing out in the fields and enjoying ourselves was fun, but that didn't save us. It was the memory that the lion is hiding out in the bushes that kept us alive. And so we have evolved to that we're not hiding, we're not thinking about the lion hiding out in the bushes, but our brains still go there. So it's the negative experiences, unless we continue to bring ourselves back, that get transferred and converted into long-term memory, mm-hmm. easier than the positive. Mm-hmm. So to remember that's the practice of moving those positive experiences into long-term connection. So that is what we recall. Is very helpful. I think it's helpful for us to be accepting of ourselves, to love ourselves, to realize that it's not just, I just always go back to that negative thought. Why do I do that? But then it's like, oh, okay, that's that Velcro. And those positive thoughts just need a little more nurturing, just need a little more time to dwell upon. I mean, the neuroplasticity, our brains, they used to think we're set. We have so many cells, they die off, we're set. But they're actually finding out that we grow new cells. I'm reading a book called Spark right now about exercise in the brain, and they actually say that when we work out really vigorously, it creates new cells. And then if we apply ourselves to something, some challenge, some intellectual challenge, immediately after that, it sets it. It gives those cells some place to go, in our brain. And so they're actually studying the exercise programs in schools, doing them first thing in the morning, and then having the kids do their toughest assignments. And so if you have a test to take or you have some big thing you need to do, you know, run around the block a few times before setting into that. And so that's very hopeful to know that our brains are plastic, and we can create, we can expand our hippocampus, which is the part that takes on stress through these practices that Ernest Holmes was telling us about 100 years ago, without having the viability of MRIs, you know, and SPECT scans and things like that help us really see the what's actually really going on in our brain. So I like this image that Rick Hansen talks about. He said, attempt to be the cue ball and not the eight ball. The eight ball is subject and gets kicked around and knocked around and pointed and, you know, I'm going in that hole, I'm over there. And the cue ball is what's guiding, what's directing, that's in control. So if we think of that with our thoughts, that we want our thoughts to be a cue ball and not the eight ball, then that's, I just think, a very nice way to think about it, to think about that that's what our practice is. So I want to expand a little bit into this idea of gratitude. And the book is by Robert Emmons, and it's called Thanks, How the New Science of Gratitude Can Make You Happier. And it's a great book. It has some wonderful studies in it. But I want to read this quote fairly, it's a fairly lengthy quote, but I want to just kind of set the tone for this about what gratitude is. And he says, the evidence that cultivating gratefulness is good for you is overwhelming. Gratitude is a quality that we should aspire to as part and parcel of personal growth. This wisdom derives not only from ancient philosophies and theologians, but also from contemporary social science research. Analysis of the Hebrew Scriptures, the New Testament, and the Quran have all exposed gratitude as central among the virtues they extol. Contemporary social science research has now ratified this ancient wisdom, concluding that gratitude stimulates a host of benefits. Specifically, we have shown that gratitude is positively related to such critical outcomes as life satisfaction, vitality, happiness, self-esteem, optimism, hope, empathy, and the willingness to provide emotional and tangible support of other people, whereas being ungrateful is related to anxiety, depression, envy, materialism, and loneliness. Collectively, such studies present credible evidence that feeling grateful generates a ripple effect through every area of our lives, potentially satisfying some of our deepest yearnings, our desire for happiness, our pure pursuit of better relationships, and our ceaseless quest for inner peace, wholeness, and contentment. Gratitude is more, though, than a tool for self-improvement. Gratitude is a way of life. It's a way of life. And I've often thought that all the answers to life's problems can actually really be found in the five steps of treatment, spiritual mind treatment. That if we just studied those five steps the rest of our life, it would be sufficient. And of course, gratitude is prominently in there in the fourth step, and probably through all of the steps. Because if you're in your recognition step, how can you not feel grateful? If you're unifying with the divine, how can you not feel grateful? If you're focusing your thoughts and recognizing the good that is already in your life, how do we not feel grateful for that? And of course, in release, there has to be a sense of trust, which comes from gratitude, to release. So really, in a way, it's like the foundation of our practice in spiritual mind treatment. So let's talk a little bit more about what gratitude is, because when I read this book, it really helped me expand on what we're doing when we're being in a place of gratitude. Walter Healy says, happiness is not created by what happens to us, but our attitude towards each happening. And again, that's really a powerful principle in the science of mind. It's not really matter. It's not what's going on. It's how we take it in. It's how we see it, how we perceive it, how we react to it. And so Robert Amon says that there's two elements of gratitude. He says one is recognizing. It is knowing. It's the knowing awareness that we are recipients of goodness. the knowing awareness that we are recipients of goodness. And I think that that's, you know, that's a powerful thing, because we kind of have to be vulnerable in order to really acknowledge that we're receiving and that we are part of this interconnected world. We can't do things ourselves, that the sense of recognizing that it's even there. And the second one is acknowledging, which is a part of that, which I just mentioned. There must be an active acknowledgement. That acknowledgement includes that we are interdependent, that we couldn't survive without the help of others in our lives. And Robert Amon talks a little bit about this interconnectedness, and that if we just stopped and thought about what all the other people in the world had to do in order for us to be here, even in this moment. You know, there had to have been roads built, and people had to learn how to make cars, and the, you know, the hotel staff had to show up today to open up the doors, or we wouldn't be able to be here. You know, Connie had to organize it all and invite me and John had to learn how to play all that music, and that's a vulnerability, and that's that interconnectedness, that none of us do this alone. None of us can find, I mean, truly, survive, much less find contentment and happiness and abundance and love on our own. That's just that in itself is a powerful place to begin with our gratitude, knowing that we are all so interdependent. And that's what brings us to this sense of trust. David Steindl-Rast, who's a wonderful priest, and he talks a lot about forgiveness mostly, and gratitude. He says, all gratitude expresses trust. Suspicion will not even recognize a gift as a gift. Who can prove that it isn't a lure, a bribe, a trap? Gratefulness has the courage to trust and so overcomes fear. You know, I think we've all been in that position where we do something, and maybe if you have teenagers, you understand this more. But where you do something nice, and then the person says, "What do you want? You know, what do you want from that?" And there's that sense of distrust. I mean, you cannot be in a place of gratitude and not trust that it was genuinely meant as a gracious gift. I mean, even thinking, if you think about, well, what everybody has to do, you can't come up with ways of cynicism, like, well, they get paid to be here. This is what their job is. But doesn't it feel so much better to think that these people have a purpose, that they know that they're needed, that their desire is to support us and lift us up and create this society and be here? I mean, it's the energy is completely different, and there has to be an assuming of good, of looking for the good in people, and knowing that ultimately that is really the intention of everyone, even those people who are doing things that we might think are negative in some way. Then underneath that, we believe in the divine goodness in all life, all people. So I like David Steindl-Rast says this, which is, I think, it's just a really profound thought. He says, you can feel either grateful or alienated, but never both at the same time. Gratefulness drives out alienation. There is not room for both in the same heart. When you are grateful, you know that you belong to a network of give and take, and you say yes to that belonging. You cannot have alienation and gratitude in the same heart. That goes back to our first step of recognition and unification. You know, if you're unifying with the divine, you can't have a sense of alienation. And so if you're stepping into a place of gratitude about that unity, you can't have alienation. You know, that practice Emerson, I think. Or was it Eckhart who said, you guys might know this. Was it Eckhart that said, is it the only prayer you ever say is thank you, that is sufficient? Is it Eckhart? Yeah, Mr. Eckhart. The only prayer you ever say is thanks. That is sufficient. That is enough. That is enough. Yeah. Yeah. So what? So let's just go home, right? I have a quote here. It's a larger, it's a bigger quote, but this one little idea is one grateful thought changes everything. One grateful thought changes everything. If you think about that, that's that energy. When you're in that place of, you know whatever, you're thinking about something negative in your life, or you're in a situation, or you're in the car and you're driving, and if you can just reach for that one grateful thought, that changes the whole trajectory. It changes the whole energetic shift. Just that one thought, that brain, that one grateful thought, changes everything. So it's not this little, when we talk about, I'll be grateful, give thanks. It's really not, it's not a small thing at all. Hi, come on in. So what are some ways that we can dip deeper into this practice of gratitude? Richard Amon gives us three different things to think about. And first of them is being present in the moment, living in the moment, and having a touchstone, kind of like bringing yourself back to the present moment, but having a touchstone of gratitude, of love, of joy. And when I was thinking about this touchstone, I was remembering my son, who's now 14, when he was about 5 years old, we got a new kitten. And we just love this kitten. His name is Henry. And Henry was such an adorable kitten, of course. I know no one here likes cats, right? And so this kitten is just so, so sweet. And he said one day, he's looking at Henry and he says, "Oh, don't you just love Henry? You want to talk about him?" Talk about him. And it's like, so we started saying that whenever, but it was that touchdown. It's like he loved his kitty cat so much that just that idea of talking about him just brought in this wonderful, great feeling. And I thought that it was very serendipitous, because this morning when I was thinking about that, about Henry, my at the time my youngest son was one, he couldn't say Henry, he'd say Henry. So we called him Henry. And I was getting ready to leave, and I thought, I'm going to take some CDs with me to listen to in the car. And so I went into my library, and I pulled a CD off, and out fell a picture of Henry as a kitten. And I don't know how it got in there, but I'll pass it around. He's a little Aussie cat. He had cross eyes, and so I thought, well, that's serendipitous. I need to bring Henry with me for our time together today, just that sense of, and we can talk about Henry. Henry's no longer with us in physical form, but he's still in our hearts. So Amon talks about the three P's of practicing gratitude. And the first is presence yourself to gratitude. And I know that you already know about gratitude journals. You've probably heard about them forever, but that is something that they have proven over and over again really works. It really works to bring yourself to the present moment, to every day think about something that you're grateful for, to really bring it down to very specific things. I'm grateful for my car starting. I'm grateful for the beautiful daffodils. And we just moved, we moved into our current home about 6 months ago, and it was fall. And so now the spring is kind of a little gift, because the owners before us had done all this planting. And so now all these great things are popping up everywhere, and it's like a gift every time. It's like exciting to go out and see, well, who planted this before I came? It was, setting the stage for me, and so I get these little gifts. So he says that people that actually do gratitude journals can raise their happiness set point. And we think that, as you might have heard of the happiness set point, everybody's kind of have their level of happiness, and if a great, wonderful thing happens, you've been happy for a while, but then you go back to your set point, and if you have negative things happen, you might be sad for a while, but you kind of always go back to your set point. But they're finding out now that this practice actually can raise your regular set point of happiness by 25%.
Wow.
Which is pretty good, right? So the practice of it is so important. And then the second P is prayer, which of course we know, as I've been talking about, that our prayer process of spiritual mind treatment already has gratitude woven into every aspect of it. And he was saying that that people who pray, even pray to experience gratitude. You know, if you're thinking, I don't even know what I can be grateful for, and I think we've probably all been in that place, but even just to open ourselves up to allow the divine to show us to experience that gratitude. And he said that people that pray for their success or for their gratitude actually do more steps. They do more steps for their success. They actually go out to accomplish those goals. So people who pray actually move their feet. They move their feet, and they get out into the world. So it's much more, it allows us to actually have the energy to go out and do the things that we need to do to connect with that, which is so our part of our gratitude. So, and then the third thing he says is props. We need props. The two main obstacles to being grateful are forgetfulness and the lack of mindful awareness. So that goes back to that positive experience is Teflon, and the negative experience is Velcro. The positive experiences slip away faster. We forget that which has happened to, that is good to us, good for us. Rick Hansen says that our brains, the way our brains work, is that when we have something happen, an experience happen to us, it doesn't get filed away. That whole event doesn't get filed away into our brain. Just little implicit memories do. So how we felt, a color, a smell. And so then when we want to recall that memory, we touch those implicit memories, and then our brain rebuilds that memory. And then we are able to recall it. And then when we're not recalling that memory anymore, it actually kind of goes away into this kind of rabbit hole of our brain. And actually, when those memories do that, they're vulnerable to change. So we can actually begin to overlay positive experiences over those negative experiences so that when we recall that up, if we can connect it with a positive, eventually it clears away the negative feelings and the negative experiences. It's kind of like that drop of clean water in the dirty cup of a glass of water. It's just slowly, and then so, you know, it really is not too late to have a happy childhood. You know, we can really pull up those negative feelings and change them and change how we feel about them. And he calls it calling in the good, feeling the good, and really touching base with that. And he talks about the practice of doing that is taking in the good. Calling in the good is good too. But taking in the good. And so he says that if you have a negative experience that can't seem to go away, or you're wanting to heal some experience, that it might be a good practice for you to do this. He does say that if you're severely depressed, it may not be the best activity for you, because sometimes we can't pull that up. But if we're for mild, childhood memories or things that you're wanting to work on, or average work that we do in our spiritual life, that we start by recalling that negative memory, and then you have to be able to hold these two things in mind at the same time, and you have to also not get caught up in the negativity. So it's really just a meditative practice of finding that negative. In my mind, I kind of see it down here, the negative, and then having that positive experience. And when you draw that negative experience up, overlay it with the positive. And it's kind of like, I know when you're in practitioner training, and practitioners do this in religious science, it's about finding the spiritual truth of the negativity. Mm-hmm. So if you have something that continues to haunt you from your childhood, Rick Hansen calls it your hole in your heart. What is the hole in your heart? And if when I was thinking about this about for myself, that when I was growing up, my parents were entrepreneurs. They were ranchers. And in the ranching business, it's feast or famine. So either you got a lot or you got nothing. And it was it could be a pretty emotionally bouncing back. And so the spiritual truth behind that I call into that experience of not knowing or feeling the stress of my parents or the worry that the banker was going to take our home or whatever that feeling was, that the positive touchstone is, you know, all is well, that there is an abundance in the universe, that I think about the steadiness in my life, the constant knowing that no matter what, my whole life, there's always been someone who loves me. There was a steadiness. You think about the sun. It could be just the rays of the sun. Every single day has come up, that steadiness and the abundance of the flowers, especially this time of year. And so that touchstone, that spiritual truth that underlies that, oh, there's not enough, it's not secure, is divine abundance as always being loved. So we can pull that down. The same way with relationships. When my parents had a tumultuous relationship, to say the least, I saw a lot of conflict and fighting over the 23 years they were married. And when I was in my 20s, I kind of recreated that in lots of ways because I just thought that's the way it was. And I had bosses that were married, and they had this totally different relationship. They really enjoyed being with each other. They loved traveling together. They were always helpful to each other. They talked to each other. And they became my touchstone. And then I started looking around for it. You know, I'd have this, oh, this is what relationship is. Relationships are hard. Relationships can be traumatic. And then I think, you know, but my touchstone is love and companionship and enjoying traveling together and you know, happiness and laughter and command, you know, all those things brought that down. And so I encourage you in your spiritual practice to try this, taking in the good, this feeling that sense. And it's not just, it's a memory, but it's visceral, because that's how we create those implicit memories. It's how did it feel? How did it smell? How did it make you, how did it look? What were the sounds involved? And really take that in. And even if you just do that, that practice in and of itself is a powerful practice. So taking in the good is a wonderful practice for our gratitude. So in conclusion, when you think about, I want to talk about this quote from Ernest Holmes in this writing that we had, because I think it kind of brings it all together. You know, we want to be the cue ball, not the eight ball. When we control our thoughts, we want our cue ball to be directing our life. And we want to be in that place of gratitude. As Eric Butterworth said, you know, Thanksgiving is not a reactionary emotion. It's a causative energy. It's not about reacting to something. It's about causing something to happen, to bring us, bring into our life. So Ernest Holmes said in this excerpt, he's talking about Jesus. And he said, he knew that everything is made out of mind, and that without that positive acceptance on the part of the individual, there is no mold into which mind can pour itself forth into form. And that is our practice, isn't it? To open up and to allow the divine to pour itself into us, into the mold that we are. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you too.